Very quickly, I want to talk through the issue of tithing. I don't think this requires a great deal of content, but there are a few things that I want to say about tithing, because it can be a somewhat controversial issue for some in the church. Tithing was commanded in the Old Testament by the Mosaic Law. The idea that the 10% of the first of whatever you took in was to be dedicated to the Lord your God was an absolute command. There's simply no reasonable dispute or debate on this matter. If you were a farmer, the very first 10% of the crops that you took in would go to the Lord. You did not wait until you saw the whole of your harvest and then make a 10% calculation. You knew what you planted. The first 10% of what came up went to Him. If you had livestock, the first 10% went to Him. If you were a tradesman or a merchant, the first 10% you brought in went to Him. We would call this a gross calculation. All the money you take in, pre-tax, pre-any, the government does not get their piece before God gets His, 10% gross goes to the Lord. That was the Mosaic Law. Evidently, this was a requirement from God even prior to Moses. Can you think of a story in the Bible where someone brings an offering to God before the time of Moses?
Abraham,
let's go earlier. Abraham himself tithes to Melchizedek. I want to go earlier. Cain and Abel. Now, it reminds us a good principle about the Bible in general. The Bible doesn't record everything that God ever said to His people. Because when we have the situation with Cain and Abel, one presents an acceptable offering, one presents an unacceptable offering. We have no idea what it was about those offerings that made them acceptable or unacceptable. We have no idea what the standard was by which God judged their offerings. The Bible doesn't tell us that. But it is clear from the text that God had told them that. God had told Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, here's what you have to do, here's what's acceptable and here's not. So this idea of bringing offerings to the Lord goes back even earlier than Moses, though the Mosaic Law established the 10%. In Malachi 3, the most common passage reference when you talk about tithing, a failure to tithe or the presentation of an inadequate tithe is referred to as what? What does God say? Why do you rob me? Israel says, how do we rob you? God says, you rob me with your tithes and your offerings. And then notice, if you go back to that passage, God doesn't say, you don't give me anything. God says, you give me these sickly goats. You don't give me the good goats. You give me the ones that were dead anyway. You don't give me the grain that you wanted to eat. You give me the broken and the crushed grain that nobody wants. It's that inadequacy of the offering that God is not pleased with. In Matthew 23, Jesus has an interaction with the Pharisees where He criticizes the fact that they perform ritual activities, but their hearts miss the main point of the law. So they tithe even on their dill and their cumin. They were tithing on their garden herbs. The mint would come up in their garden and they would take the first 10% off the top of the mint and tithe that. So diligent were they in their tithing. And yet they did not pursue justice. They were not merciful. And so Jesus goes after them on those issues. But does Jesus tell them the tithing is worthless and stupid and you never should have done it? What does He say at the end of that passage? He says you should have done both. So in the New Testament, Jesus reaffirms to them that the principle of tithing, of giving your first fruits to the Lord, is a legitimate principle. In Galatians 6:6, Paul reaffirms the principle that those who sit under the ministry of the Word should financially support the ministry of the Word. If you benefit from a church, you should contribute so that the church can exist. And that's actually the main picture as you look through the first few chapters of Acts, specifically Acts chapter 3 and 4. you no longer have in the New Testament the sense of the Mosaic law of this rigorous 10% requirement. You have the idea of if you benefit from the ministry, you ought to provide financially for that ministry so that it can exist. A tent-making pastor simply cannot be as effective and as fruitful in his pastoral duties as a full-time pastor. Would everybody agree with that? You just cannot do both well. Well, how's the pastor going to eat? Well, somebody's got to pay him. Who should pay him? Should the government pay him? No, the people who sit under the ministry of the Word should pay him. We can worship God, not more effectively, but we can worship God with fewer distractions in a building that has lights and air conditioning. Do you agree with that? Who should pay for the lights and the air conditioning? Well, the people who sit under the ministry of the Word. So that's the New Testament principle that is affirmed. So here's what I want to say about tithing. The New Testament does not explicitly require a 10% tithe. I don't think that you can make that argument effectively from the New Testament. The only time the tithe or the 10% issue is mentioned is when Jesus is dealing with people who are still under the Old Testament law, or at least consider themselves to be under that law, and he reaffirms that principle in their case. So I don't think you can say that the New Testament explicitly requires a 10% tithe. But I don't believe that that's because the New Testament does away with it. I think it's because the New Testament teaches an overwhelming and a pervasive ethic of generosity. And it doesn't want you to be bound to merely 10%. That's why I think the New Testament does what it does. There is continuity between the Testaments. We don't throw away the 10% issue just because it's the New Testament is silent on the issue. We've talked about that before. We would need the New Testament to explicitly teach that the 10% is no longer valid for us to say that it's completely overturned. But in the Old Testament, there was more than the 10%. There was your tithe. There was also the temple tax. There was also the head tax. And there was also that principle of being generous with people who are in need. The idea of caring for your mother and father in their time of need. The idea of providing those who are in distress. The idea of loaning money to people without ever charging interest, as was the practice among the, at least the faithful within Israel. There is this ethic of generosity in the Old Testament that carries over to the New. And I think our mindset needs to be that the 10% is a starting point of our generosity or of our obligation even to God. Practically speaking, I would say that you do have a financial obligation to your local church. And I think 10% is a reasonable number for that local obligation. We're taught throughout Scripture to be generous, not to be lovers of money, and to trust God to provide for all of our needs. Part of what we're doing when we give up that money is we're putting our money with our mouth, where our mouth is. We say we trust God to provide all our needs. We say that we trust God. We say that He will give us exactly what we need. We say that the children of God never want for bread. But man, it's hard to pull those dollars out of our clenched fists, isn't it? And when you voluntarily hand that money over, that'll preach in terms of you actually demonstrating the trust that you have for God to provide. Tithing is also an act of worship. And for that reason, I do suggest, and let me be very clear, that we're in the suggestion portion of the program this morning. We are not in the legislation portion of the program. I do suggest putting something in the plate every week. Now, I know that most of us have jobs, get paid biweekly or monthly or however you do that, and you just write a check when your paycheck comes, and I understand that. I'm not saying that you need to divide your income into 52 equal portions and put that in the... I'm saying that tithing is an act of worship. One of the reasons that we have communion every week in this church is because the congregation and the elders, when the church was established, have believed that we should make all proper use of the means of grace. And so you don't have the Lord's Supper every week because you're required to, but you come at it from the angle of, well, why wouldn't we? If it's an opportunity to partake of the grace of God and it's permissible to do it, why wouldn't you? Why would you miss out on that opportunity in a given week? Well, I'd encourage you to think about tithing in the same way. Tithing is an act of worship. There is something spiritual about taking that which God has given to us and returning a portion of it back to Him. And so even if it's, you know, the couple bucks of cash that you had in your pocket, whatever it is, that part's almost inconsequential in terms of how you work out the ratio. But just that act of worship, of putting something in the plate, I think that's especially useful for our children, is having them participate in the worship service in that way by returning something to God, by physically making use of that means of grace and being reminded that the Lord has been good and gracious to us. It's not just paying our dues. It's hold on one second. It's not just setting up a monthly bill pay the way I do my electric bill. I'm not saying you can't do that. But I'm saying there's value in the act of worship, in giving unto the Lord physically. And you shouldn't neglect that. You shouldn't remove that practice from your experience of worship.
You know, some of these modern churches that are trying to get away from traditional things have a tithe box in the back.
Yeah.
We started that in Fort Lauderdale for a while, and then I was on a session. I said, we're missing out on worship by not tithing.
There's a church in Florida where the pastor spent 25 minutes explaining to the congregation during the worship service how they could give them their bank account number and their routing number and have the church do direct drafts on their checking account. I'm sure that's effective in increasing tithe percentage and it helps with revenues. I'm not convinced that that is an appropriate way to function as a church. I think you ought to be generous. I think your generosity ought to start here with the ministry which serves you. And my practice has been, just for our family, 10% of all of our income goes to our local church. And extra generosity goes to other ministries and missions and things that we support and are encouraged by and want to see succeed. I don't think it's appropriate to take money from your that should be for your local church, the ministry that serves you, and to give that to other ministries, other churches, other missions agencies, things like that. You need to fulfill your obligation to this church, and really, you need to read the first few chapters of Acts if that's something that you wrestle with. But the picture that the apostles painted is a clear one of we're in ministry together. This community exists for the sake of all of us living before God and living with one another, and it takes money to run the show. It takes money to have air conditioning and to have lights and to have a pastor and to have elements at communion and to have hymnals and to have music, and those things cost money. And so that is a very functional purpose of the tithe, which is also an act of worship as you give that unto the Lord. So questions or comments about giving? I don't like to get hung up on the 10% number because I think it's under generous. Isn't it amazing when people run for political office and they have to, their tax statements have to be made public and you can actually see how much money they gave to charitable organizations? And you've got these politicians who think that politicians who take very government-heavy political views that we have to be, the government has to be generous and the government has to provide all of these resources for all these down and out people. And then when you look at their own taxes, they don't give anything. So great is their care for the poor that they gave 0.75% of their income to some charitable organization. I mean, it's laughable. Remember, this is a inquiries class for everyone. So what we're talking about is how to join a church or how to join this church specifically. But here's an issue I want to talk about before we finish. Why and how to leave a church. I've never heard anyone teach Christians how to leave a church. And let's be honest. At some point in your adult life, the odds are very, 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 very good that you will voluntarily leave a church. I'm not talking about your job moves you to another city. I'm not talking about you need to move to be closer to family. And I'm talking about making a voluntary, conscious decision. We are going to leave this church, either to go to that one, or we're just going to leave this church. We're all going to do it, just statistically. We're all going to do that. And yet we don't ever learn how. I'm going to start with why, and then I'm going to move to how. And if you have questions or comments or feedback, feel free to stop me, and we'll address those as we go. I'm sort of flying solo here because, like I said, there's very few resources out there that relate to this issue. Primary principle number one, under the heading of why you should leave a church. Principle number one, you should not leave a church. I'm going to get to primary principles two and three, but I need to start with primary principle number one. You should not leave a church. The place you need to begin when you think about leaving a church, and really, it's most helpful if you can begin there before you ever join the church, because then you'll head off a lot of problems early on, is ask yourself, why am I joining this church? Or why did I join this church, if you already had? What are some of the reasons why people join a particular church?
Ooh. Yeah, we'll say easy. It's easy to get to, easy to join,
whatever kind of easy it might be. But actually, that's reason number two. Go ahead, Beck. Doctrine, so we'll call that agreement
with doctrine. That's actually, I'd say, about reason number five.
In terms of most common reasons people join a church. What's that? Yeah, that actually is 1.5. What can it do for my children? There's only one reason more common than that. What are other reasons people join a church? Programs we'll put in with children. I'm going to change preaching just a little bit. And I'm going to write pastor. Because it's not about the preaching. It's about the pastor. People join because of the personality or the giftedness of the pastor. That is the number one reason people join a church. You want to go look in Charlotte and figure out why not a church where everybody has a bumper sticker for it, it's the fastest growing megachurch in the country, has 5,000 people? It's the personality of the pastor and the giftedness of the pastor. He's an incredible communicator.
Style of worship.
Yeah, agreement with style of worship. We'll call that worship. Or we'll call it practices. And then another one I'd add is agreement with vision. We like where this church is headed.
We like what they're about. All right. Is this a good reason to join a church? Because the pastor is personally gifted or an excellent preacher?
No.
No.
He might die.
He might die. I hadn't really thought of it that way. He might die. Children's programs. Is that a good reason to join a church? Convenience? Then we get into the agreement section. Now I'm going to surprise you on this one. Agreement with doctrine, agreement with practices, agreement with vision. Is that a good reason to join a church? Sort of. But you have to go deeper than this, and I'll tell you why. You should join a church Not because you agree with what they do right now. You should join a church because you've had a conversation or multiple conversations or multiple class setting experiences like this one, where you become convinced that you're in agreement with why they do these things. You need to believe that the officers of that church are faithful to the Scriptures and desire to do what they do, to say what they say, to believe what they believe, to practice what they practice, because the Scriptures say so. You can go to a church and you like the way that church does worship, because you like hymns and they sing hymns. And you can go through the new members class and you can hear everything they have to say about joining the church, and you can join the church, and 2 weeks later you can sit in a congregational meeting where the session tells you, we're not going to sing hymns anymore. We've done some demographic surveys. This area is growing, but it's growing with young people. We need to do music that appeals to young people. So we're changing our 11 o'clock service. It's now going to meet at 8:53, because that is really cool. We're going to sing out of a different book. We're getting rid of the hymnals. We're pulling it. I'm not making a statement about whether those things are right or wrong. I think you know how I feel about them. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about you joining a church. You joined because you agreed with their practices. And then what happened 2 weeks later? They changed all their practices. You shouldn't join a church because you agree with what they do now. You should join a church because in your thoughtful and careful analysis of the pastor and the elders or the leadership, if it's not a Presbyterian church, you believe that they want to be faithful to the Scriptures, and that they believe that all three of these things, doctrine, practices, and vision, every part of them must be grounded in the Scriptures. So that if they say, we're not going to do hymns anymore, we're going to do this other kind of music, their next sentence does not involve the phrase demographic study, but instead involves the phrase Scripture says. That's what you need to be looking for. I'm going to join a church because I believe the officers of that church are faithful to the Scriptures. Consider what you say in the vows that you take when joining this church. Vow number 6. Do you promise with the Lord's help to be faithful in the performance of your Christian duties, both in private life and in the work of the church? You vow something about having duties in the work of the church. Let me ask you a trick question. Does this local church exist to serve you or to provide you with a place to serve? I helped you out by saying it was a trick question. What's the answer?
Both.
Now, a lot of people fall off the other side of this horse and say, church isn't about you at all. This church doesn't have to do anything for you. You need to be a giver and not a taker. If everybody in the church is a giver and nobody's taking, to whom are we giving? Just something to think about there. The church exists for both of those purposes. To serve you and to provide you with avenues of service. And you can't forget either one of those. There is an aspect in which someone can reasonably say, a church ought to meet my needs. But what you need is a biblical analysis of what your needs are. A program for your children does not fit in the category of needs. Convenience does not fit in the category of legitimate biblical needs. Are my children being ministered to, and am I being equipped to raise my children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord? That's a completely legitimate question. And if you're a parent, it ought to be high up on the list. But does this church have, you know, 4 nights a week activities for my children to come to and only ever hang out with Christian kids so that they've never seen a pagan in their life until they get to college? It's a bad choice. That was sort of a loaded way, I guess, of making that point. You take vow number 7. Do you submit yourself in the spirit of love to the government and discipline of this church and seek the peace, purity, and prosperity of this congregation so long as you are a member of it? Everybody gets that first part, I mean, until it actually applies to you. Everybody gets the part about you submit to the government and discipline of the church in your private life. Everybody gets it until it actually becomes about them, and then suddenly this vow wasn't all that important. But what that also says is that you submit to the spirit of love and government and discipline of the church, seeking the peace, purity, and prosperity. That means that as the church makes decisions, whether it's decisions by the elders or whether it's decisions by the congregation, that's part of our form of government. And so you agree to submit to those decisions for the sake of peace and purity and prosperity. Those of you who've left congregations before, I don't want you to raise your hands, because I know the answer to this question before I ask it. Have you ever thought about how your leaving a church might affect the church's peace, unity, and prosperity? The answer is almost always no. When people leave churches, their primary consideration is themselves. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't be a consideration in that. I'm saying there's a consideration there to be balanced. What effect does my leaving have on this body right now? And we'll talk more about that in a couple of minutes. Finally, under primary principle number one, you should not leave a church. Think about marriage vows. Have you ever thought about church membership vows as seriously as you think about marriage vows? I don't know many people who have. For richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, sickness and in health. You ever been in a sick church? Had to stick it out? The vows are not the same. I don't want to suggest to you that they are. And yet there is real seriousness to vow taking in general. God says, let your yes be yes and your no be no. 1 Peter 5:5 says, likewise, you who are younger, he's just given a bunch of instruction to the elders. And now he's talking to everyone in the church who's not an elder. Likewise, you who are younger, be subject to the elders. Clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another. You have to think very carefully about the vows that you've taken and the seriousness of breaking those vows. Again, it's not the same as a marriage vow, but it is still a vow that's taken before God. All right, primary principle. Any questions about primary principle number one? You should not leave a church. All right. Yeah.
Members, we're talking about members. Where do attenders fit into this? They don't fit into.
There's no such category. If you're a regular, if you're a regular attender at a church, you either ought to be pursuing a track of becoming a member, or pursuing a track of finding somewhere else to attend.
Be a member.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The Bible has no category for Lone Ranger Christian. Not under anybody's authority. You know, not. The Bible just has no category for that. You're either a member of the covenant community, or you're not a member of the covenant. That's the picture of both testaments, Paul.
And the requirement of unbelievers on Sunday after Sunday, are they just welcome to do that?
Yes, absolutely. But part of their conversion to Christianity, when the Lord draws them to themselves, should be becoming a member of a church. Even the Arminians, who are so much better than us at evangelism, in the back of all their tracts about four spiritual laws or whatever else, what does it always say in the back of that tract? Find yourself a Bible-believing church to join. They're not even covenantal, and they get it. Primary principle number two. You should generally, remember what I say about general. This is going to be true 99.9% of the time. I am allowing some exceptions. That way I don't have to have a discussion on every single case study. You should generally leave a church only under three conditions. That is, I think there are only three legitimate reasons for leaving a church. And this, again, is apart from you moved away. Reason number one, a church... I need to write this out so you see what I'm saying. A church is no longer the church. A local congregation is no longer a part of the church invisible, the actual body of Christ. If you're a member of a Roman Catholic church, which we believe is not a true church, you recognize that that is not a true church, you should leave. But the more likely situation is that the officers of a church have taken an intentional turn against biblical truth. The congregation is unwilling or unable to reclaim biblical faithfulness, and there are no further avenues of appeal or recourse in attempt to reclaim the church for Christ. My wording is that complicated because I think this scenario is far more rare than Christians would like to believe. Now, it may not have been a true church when you joined it, and you should not have joined, and now you just got to get out of the trouble that you made for yourself. But if it was a true church when you joined it, I know churches that have changed something like music style or like they took out a confession of sin or a confession of faith and put something else in the worship service, making those kinds of changes. Or a church exercises discipline in a particular case, does it badly, or doesn't exercise discipline in a particular case where some people think that they should. There's lots of reasons people get upset. And then what they say is, they're not being a true church because they changed this thing. Listen to what I said. The officers of the church have taken an intentional turn against biblical truth. The congregation is unwilling or unable to reclaim biblical faithfulness, and there are no further avenues of appeal or recourse in an attempt to reclaim the church for Christ. Hear how complicated that is? If that happened here, and we decide bread and wine are expensive, we're going to start using Cheez-Its and water for the Lord's Supper. So, well, that's bad news. We start making changes along that line, and it becomes clear that the entire session has turned its back on biblical truth. And members of the congregation approach the session, address this issue from the Scriptures, and the session won't hear it. We're a rather defiant and ornery bunch. We just won't even listen to you. This is what we're going to do because people will like this better. Everybody likes Jesus. That's our defense. And so you appeal to the presbytery and you say, look, these people are crazy. They used to be Christians. They've gone crazy. They got Cheez-Its in here. And the presbytery says, we're pro-Cheez-Its too. You submit to your elders. Then you can leave the church. But in all my recollections of people leaving a church over issues like this, not even the first step of that got done. The minute we switch to Cheez-Its, you're all out the door. Isn't that been your experience? It's what I've seen. The officers of the church take an intentional turn against biblical truth. The congregation is unwilling or unable to reclaim biblical faithfulness. Maybe the rest of the church likes the Cheez-Its. And you go and you talk to some people, hey, look, are we going to do anything about this? And the whole congregation's against you. You're the only one who's anti-Cheez-It. Then you've done all you can do. So you leave. And there are no further avenues of appeal or recourse. Then you can leave. All right. Condition number two. Your commute is long and there is a faithful church closer to you. I believe this is a legitimate reason to leave a church. However, it does not always justify leaving, and it rarely justifies leaving right away. Let me explain. It is better to go to a church that is closer to you. That is simply better. In any measurement that you want to use, it is better to go to a church that is faithful to you. If there's faithful church A that's 2 miles from your house, and faithful church B that's 27 from your miles from your house, A is better than B. We're dealing with faithful churches. Doesn't matter if you have more friends than B. Doesn't matter if you prefer the types of stories that the preacher in B uses in his sermons. A is better than B. If you've got biblical faithful churches, one closer than the other, that's better. You'll get more opportunities to be involved in the body. You'll have more opportunities to serve. And you'll build relationships with people who are geographically close to you. And that's something that our society finds no value in, but is tremendously important. It is better to have a friend next door than a friend on Facebook. It's better. I just feel no need to defend that to you. It's just better. When you go to church close by with people who are close by, you build relationships and friendships with people who are close by. And that's just better. Right? The only way that this reason is a legitimate reason for leaving the church, however, is if you're actually going to do that. If you're actually going to become more involved in that church and build those relationships and find avenues of service. You can't just use as an excuse, somebody did something that made me mad, rather than address that real issue, suddenly transportation is an issue. There was a situation in a previous church where a family had been traveling a long distance to that church for a very long time. And then at one point, the session did something that they didn't like. They made a decision that the family disagreed with, and the family left the church. And everyone who asked, including the pastor and the session who pleaded with them for an honest answer, was told that they just decided the distance was too far. Never mind that they had been making this drive for years and years and years, and never mind the fact that a decision had just been made in the church that they clearly did not agree with. So we need to be careful that when this commute issue comes up as the rationale for moving from one church to another, that is not just being used as a cover, but that really is the honest and the real answer for why this is being done. The third condition under which I think it's appropriate to leave a church is if you or your family are not being fed in your current church. Now, I hesitated to even put this on the list, and I searched and searched as I studied and prepared this lesson for a way to keep this reason off of the list, because as easily abused as the previous reason is, this is the most easily abused of all. Someone can just decide, I'm not being fed here, I need to go somewhere else. And no matter how true or untrue that is, they seem justified in what they're doing. But what kept coming back to my attention as I thought about this list was the idea that you can't make a list that is impervious to abuse from dishonest or disingenuous people. This list, these three rationales for leaving a church, assume that the people involved are acting like Christians. And that's the best I can do is tell you that you ought not to use these as excuses, but you ought to act like a Christian and consider if these really are the reason and the justification for your leaving. This is legitimate. Leaving a church because you're not being fed is legitimate. If your theological views have changed, for instance, say you are in a Methodist church most of your life, and as you study the Bible and you learn more about Christ and the Scriptures, you change your theological views from the position of the Methodist Church to another position. it is appropriate at that point to leave. But I want you to listen to what I think is an appropriate description of what this process looks like. Your theological views have changed. There has been an ongoing process seeking to address this, and or there is an unwillingness or an inability by the church leadership to address the issue. I'll talk about it in just a few minutes, but communication is really important to making this process go well, and I think to doing the process faithfully. And that's true even when the issue is you're not being fed. You've got to have open lines of communication with the leadership of the church. Now, if it's a major doctrinal shift, you no longer believe something that's held of great esteem by that particular church or denomination, or you've changed some view, it is appropriate to have a conversation with the pastor or the session or the church leadership about that point. It is not appropriate to try and change the church from the ground up. That is, if the pastor and the session say to you, this is not what we believe from the scriptures, we believe this other view, it's not appropriate for you to try to gather up other members of the congregation around you to completely change the church. You knew what you were getting into theologically when you joined, at least you should have. And so now you cannot ask that church to change because you've come to different convictions, even if your convictions are more biblical. So the three conditions that I think need to be met, any one of these, for leaving a church is that if the local congregation, that church, is no longer part of the church, if you think that it's not a true church, if it's possible to find a faithful church closer to you than the one where you currently attend, or if you or your family are not being fed in your current church. That's the why you can leave. Let me briefly explain the how. The first, and I tried to make this alliterative so maybe it'd be easier to remember, but the first is conviction. That is, the decision to leave needs to be a spiritual decision, not one of anger, haste, revenge, or any casual emotion. It needs to be a spiritual decision that it is right, that it is the will of God for you to leave this church and to be in another one. If you are married, husbands and wives should generally share this conviction. 99% of the time, husbands and wives should agree about leaving a church and joining another one. And then I'd also add that the decision-making process, because I think it should be conviction and not impulse, the decision-making process should be measured in months and not in weeks. It takes some time to make a decision like this one. The second point is communication. So we've got conviction and communication. And this is the biggie. The pastor and the session must be made aware of your conviction and be given adequate opportunity to respond. Whichever of the three reasons you have for leaving the church, you have an obligation by virtue of your vows to the peace and purity of the church to submit to dialogue with the officers of that church. Now, everybody thinks this is the hard part, and when everybody when you go through this process and you're thinking about leaving, people try to do this in secret because they think it's going to make such a mess if they actually talk to the pastor of the session about it. But I am convinced it is just the opposite that is true. It will be easier for you. This is a gut-wrenching process. It's a difficult decision to decide to leave a church. It will be easier for you to make this decision if you participate in a conversation, in a series of conversations with the leadership of the church. Think about it. If the session is unwilling to discuss the issue with you at all, if they lash out at you harshly and criticize you for bringing anything up, well, then you have your answer right there. Now, you still need to give them some time because we all can tend to respond defensively when we feel like we're being attacked. So you need to, if you've just had one conversation, give a person or a session a couple weeks to think about how they responded. But if their demeanor doesn't change, if their attitude about the issue doesn't change, and it's still a stubborn refusal to seriously discuss and consider your conviction and the issue that you're having, then I think you have your answer right there, and it ought to be easy to leave. You need to get out of there.
If the session engages in dialogue, here's your concern, then they can do one of two things. One is to address the concern. And if they do that, well, then you have good reason to stay, great reason to stay. In fact, no reason to leave. They can also hear your conviction, your concern, and not change, but provide to you a thoughtful biblical defense for why they're not going to change, for why they're going to leave things as they are, why they think what they're doing now is right or appropriate. And if they do that, I believe you have your answer there as well. Hebrews 13:17, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they are keeping watch over your souls as those who will have to give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that would be of no advantage to you. If you go to the session with an issue, and this is not, you know, the divinity of Jesus or the exclusivity of Christianity, these are, you know, more normal secondary level church issues, the kind of stuff people get upset and leave over. If you go to the session with a disagreement about that, and the session gives you a thoughtful, biblical, or reasoned defense for why it shouldn't change and why it needs to be left the way it is, then you need to live with that. You need to pray to ask God to give you patience and understanding. You need to recognize that there's no such thing as a perfect church, and you need to live with it. Now, if you can't live with it, if it's something they won't change, and it is a serious conscience issue for you, I would strongly encourage you to give it several months. Don't make a hasty decision just because they won't change it right away. Stop, wait a few months, observe, and see. One of two things could happen. One is your conscience might become a little more tolerant of that situation because of the patience and the care and the wisdom demonstrated by the church leadership. Another is, even if the session or the church leaders don't change it to exactly the way that you wanted it to be changed, you may find that they become influenced by that conversation with you, and that there are some subtle changes that are made to make what they're doing more refined, more careful, and you may find that that alleviates your conscience concerns as well. Now, after 6 months, if nothing's changed inside of you or in the church, you have a conscience issue, you can't do it, then again, you go and you sit with them and you talk to them about that issue, but this time to say that you're leaving and to talk about how peaceably that departure can be handled. Conviction communication, the last one is concern. You need to think about the effect of your leaving on the body. Are you leaving ministry jobs unfulfilled? Did you have nursery duty next week? Did you take responsibilities for a particular activity that now there's no one to do that? Is the church trying to sustain a season of growth? This is particularly true of church plants. When you're trying to get traction, you're trying to get energy and excitement as you build a congregation, it's discouraging for people to see individuals and families leave. It just sort of is deflating. And so you need to consider, if it's not a serious moral crisis that necessitates you leaving immediately, you've got to consider, would it be better for the body if I stick it out through this initial period and then I can make my exit later if I need to? You also need to think about the timing of things. Has the church made any changes recently? Even if you are leaving for a legitimate reason, you've got to understand that not everyone in the congregation is going to hear the full or the true story about why you left. You need to at least consider the appearance of things. If you'd been planning on leaving for 6 months and had gone through this issue, but a new pastor just jumps into the pulpit and then you make your exit then, how is that going to look for people? Well, it's going to be a reflection of your opinion on the pastor, whether or not that's true. If the church just added something or took away something and that's when you leave, people are going to think the two are connected no matter what you say. So you need to be thoughtful. You need to be concerned about the body of Christ in the timing of these things. Leaving a church doesn't have to create hard feelings, heartache, and confusion for the body that's being left, but it nearly always does. I think it's a breakdown in these three C's, conviction, communication, and concern, that causes such heartache. And it'd be an amazing thing if Christians learned how to leave a church as well as they enter it.